discuss her organization, what it means for Black women to be radical and revolutionary politically. Also, earlier in the month, the Silver Spring and Van Buren United Methodist Churches held a prayer and reconsecration service on land which was once occupied by a shared historic Black cemetery, including African-American burials that were not moved at the former Montgomery Hills car wash. Denise Wright, clinical psychologist, author, and researcher, will share her research on what she calls Buried While Black. Stay tuned. Good morning. My name is Denise Young, and I am sitting in today for Marsha Coleman out of Bayou. It is always an honor to connect with such an incredible audience of fighters for justice. So when I sat with you last month, fam, WPFW presented its Justice, Inclusion, and Dignity in a Free Congo, emancipatory, informational, and inspirational programming that centered Congolese sovereignty and decolonization. And so today, in the spirit of justice and decolonization, we have an incredible show. But before we get started, I ask that we just take a few moments to open our hearts with gratitude for the work, vigilance, and revolutionary love of some of our most recently appointed ancestors. Asada Shakur, Mother Viola Fletcher, Jimmy Cliff, and H-Rap Brown, Jameel Abdullah Alameen. And if you in your circles of revolutionaries have or know someone who has become an ancestor, we also lovingly and reverently hold space and honor them too. Thank you. Our first guest today is Yejide Onramila, again, president of the African National Women's Organization. Yejide, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate having an opportunity to be on the show. I'm ready for it. Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Well, to begin with, I have been knowledgeable about ANWO probably for a few years, and I believe I first came really into an understanding about it when meeting Chairman Amalia Shatella, you know, with the African People's Socialist Party. So why don't you tell us about ANWO?
Yeah, okay. So ANWO has been in existence since 2015. So this was our 10th year. And we were born as a revolutionary project of the African People's Socialist Party to specifically deal with the issues that impact African women and the issues that come as a result of being colonized as a part of the African nation. So we want to recruit African women into the revolution, right? Like, we want African women to understand that the way that we get free, the way that we overturn our relationship to the system, is by working toward a free and liberated Africa and African people overall, as opposed to some of the things that we were talking about today in terms of like U.S. politics. And so the African People's Socialist Party is the leadership of the African People, African National Women's Organization. It is a mass organization. Anybody, any African woman can join. And this is the opportunity for people to learn more about, you know, what it means to be a part of the African Revolution. And we have campaigns and things like that that will help energize and activate African women to deal with the issues that impact majority of African women around this country and beyond. And it's also a way for African women to align themselves with other African women in other places around the world who are also fighting to obtain freedom and justice outside of the context of the status quo.
Okay, so one of the things that you consistently said was African women. And I just want to highlight that, because I think sometimes it is jarring for our community to hear the word African, right? Mm-hmm. And so I want you to explain to our audience what that means and why that term is and why you are using that term.
I'm using this term because, you know, Chairman puts it very as simply as possible. You know, we were brought on the boat as Africans and we landed here as Africans. The Atlantic Ocean is not some sort of transportation warp zone where you become something else. You know?
Right.
It's just a body of water and we are African people regardless. And I think to even say that now, as in this day and age, is to say that we reject the colonial names and designations that have been given to us by the colonizers. I think even more, it is in alignment with our homeland, right? Like things that have been taken from us, a whole entire continent that has been taken from us, and the resources that have been used to enrich everyone else, but African people still suffer as a result of that exploitation. It's like if we don't hold on to that, right? Like if we don't hold on to that, even in words, then we allow everybody else to hold on to it and take from it. And it's a connection to that. That is our homeland, the biggest continent, like one of the biggest continents on the face of the planet. It has so many general resources that it is ours to claim. And so it's also a connection to all other African people around the world, whether they're in Africa or anywhere else. And this is our, we are a nation of people that was dispersed through this colonial attack on our African continent. And it is a general sense of sameness with other African people around the world.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is so important to hear because we hear, because, you know, social media is flooded with conversations that I think divisive doesn't even capture, you know, what we hear and what we see. It's sort of like we see all of these really hard demarcations of, well, you know, you're Caribbean or you're Nigerian or you're Ghanaian, you know, or you're, you know, foundational Black American. And that's not to say that there isn't nuance, right? That comes from, you know, our experiences from being colonized in those places, but that the thread is that we originated from the motherland, and that colonized experience is, you know, is the thing that we should be recognizing, is what we should be fighting against. Yeah. So I really wanted to highlight that point because you, and I just listened to you and I said, this is, and it, your invoking African is so natural, right? So natural, you know, versus sometimes when we even think about it in terms of, you know, different, you know, political kinds of, you know, and academic leanings, like when we're talking about Pan-Africanism versus this or versus that, but just so natural. And I really appreciate that. And we need to be speaking in those terms because it does it does remind us that we, you know, not just our connection to each other, but it really highlights who our enemies are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the reasons I was also very interested in talking with you and about your organization and really being able to lay out what your objectives are is because here we are a year after, you know, the election, the presidential election, and we have, you know, the air quotes, the 92%, which represents, you know, Black women in the United States who continuously say, hey, you guys should have listened to us. You guys should have listened to us. And so I, a year later, I'm, you know, I've been pondering that. And it's not in a disparaging way, but it's just really to be able to look very critically at, well, what is it that we should have been listening to and what were the lessons that we should have, you know, taken away. So for instance, we know that when with Black women, an incredible effort, right? Mm-hmm. When you really think about what was accomplished. So, you know, 44,000 women on a Zoom call, you know, like you snapped your fingers, Biden endorsed Kamala. And like I said, you snapped your fingers and then 44,000 Black women mm-hmm. in this country were organized. They on a Zoom call, you know, Zooms be crashing when you got five people on it. But, you know, that technology held up for that. And then $1.5 million raised in less than 2 hours, which is historic. Mm-hmm. And then that in and of itself spearheaded them raising $81 million for presidential candidate Kamala Harris in less than 24 hours. And again, that was historic. And one of the things that I found really amazing about that effort is that what they said is that most of the donations were small dollar amounts. So it wasn't like people came in, you know, all of the people who have really deep pockets just, you know, started writing checks and they amassed this money, but that there really was a plea to, you know, everyday women and like we can do this. So I really respect and appreciate the you know, the organization, the organizing, I should say, that they did, and the, you know, reaching out to everyday Black women and making them feel a part of this. But what I'd have to ask, and you particularly with your organization, is where do you think there was a misstep? And I'm not even talking about in terms of did they do the job and get you know, Harris elected, but with that kind of organizing, were there some steps that, you know, I say we as a collective Black women, collective of Black women, that we missed mm-hmm. with that kind of power?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we have to really assess what the objectives are of Black women. What is it that we want? Is it just to elect somebody that was not Trump? Because if that was the objective, and that's what we were bringing our money towards to ensure that, then I can see it. However, but if we were backing a campaigner that was aligned with what we were also aligned with, mm-hmm. then I need to flesh that out a little bit more. So I think, because me as a Black woman, right, like as a revolutionary, I couldn't vote for either candidate, right? Like I couldn't vote for Trump, I couldn't vote for Kamala. And people might say that that's a wasted vote, but I think that it's a vote in absentia because we believe in something different than a Kamala and a Biden regime that also supported the genocide of Palestinians. We support an alternative that is not warmongering, that allows for all of the same existing status quo things that we do not like in society to continue to maintain. There was no radical change or transformation with Kamala. So we really have to accept the fact that we were just voting against Trump, right? Like the people were just voting against Trump. The missed opportunity in terms of the money raising is that we have organizations, in particular my organization as well, who are on the ground in our communities doing day-to-day work to transform our communities into real, conscious, revolutionary zones where people can understand what is happening to them, but also think differently. These organizations, my organization, require resources, right? Like we need the support of African women, African men, everybody to generate this, the internal structures that can lead to a world that is different, to a United States that is, hopefully no United States, you know, a place that is different and has a different outcome for our people. And we, I think, have the blueprint for that. However, it really shows that we were more willing to, even if they didn't vote, even if they say, okay, she doesn't align with me, you should have threw your money toward local campaign. You should have threw your money toward local organizations. You should have threw your money toward, this or that or the other that was different from what, that was being represented here. And I think it's a real self-check about what it is that we want as Black women and what we want to see in the world. Not just that we were supporting Kamala because she was against Trump, or that we supported, somebody else because they were against Trump or something like that. I think it's really important for us to recognize that.
When you, I want to go back to the point you made about not voting for either one, and this idea of voting in, absentia. Now, you in any other organization, voting process, Robert's Rules of Orders of Order, all of that recognizes, an absentia vote. In Congress, they recognize that. Why is it that you think within our community we are so afraid to utilize that as not only an option for voting, but really embracing it as not something that goes against, this or I should say is contrary to us embracing the fact that we always talk about how our ancestors died for us to have the right
That's
to
it.
vote. And we really do look at that as something that is so contrary to that, or it's defiling it in some way. Why do you think that is?
I think it would just been bullied. I think the general consensus is that Black people have been bullied by each other, but also by the Democratic Party and all these sort of efforts to kind of guilt us into making a decision that was is against our best interest. And I think I said the Democratic Party because they benefit the most from that bullying, right? Because Black women are highest represented in terms of being loyal to the Democratic Party and Black people generally speaking. And so we've had things along the along the years like vote or die, or there are actual campaigns that basically said you either vote or you're signing your death sentence, right? Like because so there is a targeted campaign against within the Black community that makes it totally incomprehensible for a Black person to vote in our interest, which would be, especially if you have two horrible candidates, to vote in our interest, which would be to vote in abstention. Or, we could put our vote somewhere else locally in the community. And I also think that we have to say more about like the fact that we have this two-party system, right? Like doesn't allow any other kind of party or any other kind of thoughts to come in and be a part of the ballot for the presidential election. So that's also another critique that I don't know how we can fix it immediately, but definitely we have to say we are always given two evils and we vote for the lesser of those two evils.
I always say that at this point it feels like they are forcing us, and I love your categorization of bullying. It feels like they are forcing us which plantation we want to live on, which is absolutely crazy. And so when you talk about interests, and I sometimes think that even sort of collectively we don't understand that. Or either we don't understand, or we don't embrace, or ex exercise this idea that if someone is meeting your interests, then the evidence of that really should be a change in your material conditions, right?
Absolutely.
And so we know we can look at every factor, every, whether it's housing, education, health. We can look at every factor and know that our conditions have not changed in, at this point, like 60 years.
More than
60 years. More, well, yeah, more than that.
that. I mean,
Absolutely.
I remember listening, seeing a quote somewhere like Black people at the end of segregation in America, not segregation, slavery in America were doing well. They got swaths of land and they had owned this amount of territory. I mean, in comparison, right? Like
Right,
I'm
right,
probably
right.
still like suffering from, the fact that the system is a colony.
Right.
But I think that, we have more people up into office and, at that time. And so we should really also think about our history as a continuum. We think in terms of pockets, like this is better than last year, or this is better than 10 years before. But the fact is that Black people have not been doing good since we were captured and brought here. I mean,
Right.
that's, we can't, like, we're starting from a point of zero, right? Like, at this point at which our ancestors' feet touched this land, to now say we've won and achieved so much, but we've achieved everything but freedom, right? We've achieved everything but, kicking, having, access to our homeland and our resources. We achieved everything but that. And even, I won't even say we haven't achieved everything. Like, I'm just speaking in a very absolute way, but there are real considerations that we have to look at as Black women and as Black people who, I mean, all of us are not revolutionaries, right? All of us don't want to be free. We just want to be okay, We just want to, we just want to live and be able to buy a house and a car and not be targeted and things like that, which is also justified, right? Like, you don't want to always have to fight and have to be dealing with the system, and you just want to be able to live. I can understand that, but the reality is you are not going to only just be able to live, because there are so many ways in which this colony can attack you, which colonialism can attack you. And it could be in your health, it could be in your education, it could be all of these things that when you go into the public sector that you're going to have to experience in one way or the other. You're not going to be able to avoid it. And so if we ever hope to experience a world where we are not fighting for every single thing, or every election cycle doesn't turn over some new kind of bill or policy that is against everything that we need to survive, then we need to fight for something more. We have to be at a point where we say, at what point do we end the fighting or the struggle, or we just masochists, like we do love the struggle, right? And I'm not into that, so I want to get free.
And your point about not everybody is a revolutionary, right? And some of us, maybe even a lot of us, we just, we just want to wake up every day, go to work, be able to feed our kids, have, a home, and just have life be life. And we understand that. So that's not disparaging, people. But your point about that's not going, you're never going to get the protection that you want. You are never going to be safe and secure in that. And one of the first things that popped into my head when you said that is when they came out with the study, I guess it was last year or 2 years ago, about Black women's health in the United States relative to childbirth and the complications that we as Black women have during childbirth. And what was really fascinating about the study is that you would think that the issues relative to how we're treated during childbirth and the outcomes would indicate an issue of poverty, but really, where there was the most harm was with women who were more educated, more affluent, who were married and had all of those things that you check off that is supposed to safeguard you, that we're taught if you do these things, right, then life is going to be okay. And so I just really appreciate you pointing that out, that we there is no such thing as safety and security for us. Okay. We have a few minutes left. I really want to talk a little bit more about when you were saying, being on the ground and, being in the communities and really looking at local efforts. Tell our audience, what are some of the things that, ANWO is doing? And I really want you to stress that, it's happening here in, in the DMV area. I met a woman, Zaï, out of Oakland. Powerful, powerful sister. So please share with our fam, our audience, a little bit more about what you mean locally and local efforts and what that looks like.
So I just want to make it clear that ANWO is an international organization. At some points we had branches in Africa and in Europe, and we're going to struggle to make those places real again. But we also have membership throughout the United States. And so Zaidi lives in San Diego, and we have comrades who live in Florida and St. Louis and things like that. So, and in the DMV, we have our branch that has been established in the DMV. So people can go to anwohuru.org to learn more about the organization and some of the projects that we are working on in more detail. But we...
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Sure. Anwohuru, U-H-U-R-U, A-N-W-O-U-H-U-R-U.org.
Okay.
To learn more about the organization and how you can be in contact with us. But we have been for, I think, like 7 years now, our main campaign have been something called Arrest CPS, where we focused in on the state-sponsored kidnapping of Black children and the criminalization of Black women through the foster care system, and how that is the modern-day slave auction apparatus.
Yes.
And how throughout the United States, it is an epidemic how many children of our children are locked up in the system. So that has been one of our major campaigns. We've done advocacy, we've done political education, we've done public education, we've done we've been in the courts with parents, and we've been on the phone calls with parents in the state and things like that. So we've co-coordinated something called the Black Mothers March every Mother's Day in Washington, D.C., where we bring organizers, but also more importantly, parents who have been impacted by the system into the city to do a major protest and to show people that, you know, you're not alone, and give these women who have been silenced for the most part an absolute voice to show, you know, what's happening to them, to lay bare that Black women are still having our children kidnapped from us and also being separated from our families and outlawed. We also have a project that we, is not as DMV, but we, it's a part of the work that we have to build the entire African National Women's Organization as a whole. We have the One Africa, One Nation Farmers Market, which is based in St. Louis. And we, is an economic development tool. So when people talk about throwing money somewhere, listen, find out more about us, but they have a donor briefing for people who are interested in learning how they can contribute to the African National Women's Organization, but how we feed our community. And we are facing food apartheid in particular parts of the cities. And then we also are building an AMWO Liberation Center, which is also a place for meeting, a liberation space. We're building liberated territory in St. Louis. And in DC, we want to do more around forming Arrest CPS committees. And we want to just organize around the issues politically around what African women are facing. Housing, we have child care, we have, I mean, all the things that, you know, impact our ability to just live. Mm-hmm. And we want to get you to a place where you can just live, but also be a part of the revolution, right? Like, be a part of making the struggle beyond just subsistence to liberation and freedom. And so we're a part of that work on the ground in communities. We have Zoom calls, but most of our work is in the community and organizing with regular to get free. Yeah.
One final question, Yejide, and that is, we understand that so many of our political movements within, you know, the United States Black Collective really have been, you know, very liberal, very status quo. Do you think it is possible for us to, as African women, and even through ANWO, to have a united or front or solidarity that actually welcomes in diversity of opinions and strategies?
Yeah, I think there are different apparatus for that. You know, we have coalition work, and even if you have a different of opinion, as long as you can align on specific issues, like, we can work together, right? Like, you believe that Black people should be free. That's the core.
Right.
Let's work together. How we get there, we can strategize around that, right? Like in coalition work. And I think even in mass organizations like the one I lead, you know, we want to hear all of what you have to say and contribute, but we also want you to work toward it too. Like, don't just come in and throw some ideas together at the wall, but like, how do you help materialize this idea that you believe or that we can collectively believe in and make something that can be instrumental in uplifting Black people out of colonialism?
Yeah, today. Thank you so much for being here, sister. We appreciate you, your knowledge, and your hard work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Denise. Appreciate you. And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You are listening to WPFW, and we will take a moment for community announcements.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of November 24th, 2025. On Thursday, November 27th at 11 a.m., there is a community Thanksgiving lunch at Busboys and Poets in Anacostia, 2004 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast Washington, D.C., where there will be meals provided for anyone who needs one. No reservation required. Come and enjoy a meal and some music. For more info, visit busboysandpoets.com. On Thursday, November 27th to Friday, November 28th, between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m., there will be a new CSA pickup location located on 1303 Marion Barry Avenue, Southeast, where Black Farm Community Supported Agriculture Program offers fresh, locally sourced produce from Black, Brown, woman-owned and values-aligned farms, and members receive a weekly share of seasonal fruits and vegetables often grown by small-scale farmers, and it reduces the carbon footprint associated with transporting food over long distances. For more info and to sign up, visit dolegrocery.org. On Saturday, November 29th, from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., there will be a We Ain't Buying It campaign rally and picket line in front of the Target store in Columbia Heights, 3100 14th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. Saturday's rally will feature national activists Senator Nina Turner, Tamika Mallory, and Reverend Jamal Bryant, all coming to D.C. to support our local boycott efforts. For more info, visit www.weaintbuyingit.com. On November 30th from 7 to 9 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe will hold Gaza on Our Minds, including all artists, poets, singers, playwrights, and town criers in the DMV. You can join their bi-weekly community gathering and discussion on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit Sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back. You are listening to What's at Stake on WPFW. So following on the heels of that really insightful, important first segment, we now bring to you Dr. Denise Wright, and she is going to be talking about an issue that's actually been very near and dear to not just what's at stake, but we've presented it for several years with the WPFW family, and that is the desecration of Black cemeteries. Coleman has been leading the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition for nearly 10 years. And this issue is so prominent and important in terms of addressing and really understanding. And so Dr. Wright will give us some more discussion and really sort of expand it, how we think about it a little bit. So welcome. Good morning, Dr. Wright.
Hello. It's good to be back with you. You know, you're my favorite radio person.
Well, I so appreciate that. You and for our WPFW listeners, who probably recognize Dr. Wright's voice. Dr. Wright has been a guest on WPFW's What's at Stake many times, but probably the most enjoyable for me is when we have co-hosted the Juneteenth programming for the last 2 years. And so I love her. I love her brilliance and her humor and her insightfulness and just the way that she views the world. So thank you again for joining us. So let's jump into it. So we have this thing where, you know, there's desecration of Black cemeteries or cemeteries that have historically held space for our dearly departed ancestors. What's going on with that?
So basically, one of the reasons in terms of what we had talked about before, you knew about some of the research that I was doing on behalf of the Mount Zion Cemetery in Georgetown. And that led to other research in terms of what was happening not only in here in the District of Columbia, but also on a regional as well as national scale, what was going on with, you know, our ancestral spaces. So one, the more I read, the more concerned I became in terms of what exactly was happening. Do people really actually know not only the historical aspect, which is extremely relevant, and it's really the residual effects of what we see today and how we things are managed. Now, I know that Adebayo has been on here a number of times, and she's talked about Moses Cemetery. I also looked into that and wrote out a few things about that. But there's also other challenges that people have gone that are remarkably similar. But, you know, the roads to oppression are always similar because it's a national, global thing. As we discussed, you know, Wimbush and I did the Osiris Papers, which is a sequel to the Isis Papers of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. And in it, she really brings home the global nature of supremacy and how the rules of oppression are international. So looking through that and seeing all these different aspects of what our ancestors endured back when they were enslaved by the colonizers, it was really, really important to kind of look at it in terms of how we are faring today. Because you guys, the last segment, you were talking about survival and freedom. Mm-hmm. And but that to me is a thing that we need to look at from a different lens. Mm-hmm. In terms of what justice means, a lot of us do not really know or understand or experienced that per se. But where we can begin is honoring the ancestors and to look in terms of how they survived, the things that they did as markers or guidelines for what we need to be doing today.
Wow. I know one of the things that, you know, when you talk about this idea of oppression and, you know, all roads are, you know, very similar. What was one of the things or a few things that you found in your research about Black burial grounds that just really reeked of anti-Blackness, oppression, colonizing, supremacy? Like, what were some of the things that you would want to highlight?
You know, everything is highlighted. It depends.
Right.
It's like a chain of events that transpires. You know, our ancestors always wanted to, you know, honor, and they carried with them, you know, their rituals and their traditions in terms of dealing with people who had passed on. And honoring them, but under the cloak of all this oppression, I looked at the Black codes, extremely stringent. That's authoritarian rule. We're dealing with today. And then also looking at the whole prospect of the grave robbing, which was very prevalent back then. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the pauper's grave. They had the other areas where Black bodies were buried. And I mean, you can only imagine coming back to, you know, bring flowers or pay homage to that person, and the grave is gone, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the medical schools, which grew exponentially throughout the 1800s, they needed bodies for medical students. So that was a cottage industry that was implemented to, you know, get these fresh bodies and be able to experiment and dissect and all of that. So there's a lot of that, you know, Harvard, a lot of the Ivy League schools, a lot of the area schools here in the district, and schools, you know, medical schools across the country engaged in this type of practice. A lot of the, as the ancestors would have it, a lot of the bones and remains have been thrown down well shafts or under buildings, and they've been discovered. And, you know, this is back, you know, this is like in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, you know, recent discoveries of these remains and how they were basically summarily discarded with no notice. The other issue in carrying from that, from the practice from this 1800s to now, is one that I found out about the corporations that need bodies. So a lot of times they have the unclaimed, and they would take the bodies and utilize them for practice for dissection and all that, and utilizing medical equipment to see if it would function and all of that. So we have a number, there's a number of entities that medical corporations, and that they sell equipment and what have you, and they have different contracts with people, namely, you know, some people, you know, the U.S. government also is involved in this in terms of taking unclaimed bodies and utilizing them for experimentation.
So I know when I asked that question, as you said, everything needs to be highlighted. I know that a lot of times when we are talking about the desecration of Black cemeteries, that we usually, the discussion is about, you know, typically that there has been, you know, some developer who wants the land. And so, you know, they're not interested in contacting the descending community, and, you know, which is what you're supposed to legally do, you know, so that if they, you know, want to move those bodies and place them elsewhere, they can. But I don't think that we have really had a discussion nationally that the desecration of Black cemeteries, right, and taking it even further to the desecration of the Black body. Like, this isn't just, oh, there's a burial site with Black people and we know they have no value and we don't care about their descendants because Black people in this country, we do not recognize their humanity. So, you know, even though everywhere else in the world, you know, every other culture across the world recognizes that there is something reverent, right, about, you know, the rituals behind honoring the deceased. But here, you know, we find that, no, it doesn't happen. But when I hear you talk about, no, they will go into these graves. It's not just we want to build land on them. They will take these bodies, and there is other use. And so how does that correlate with what we see in general with, you know, how the Black body is viewed, you know, whether it's here domestically or globally?
Yeah, so the grave robbing was prevalent in the 1800s. I think into the 1900s, they had the Anatomy Act. They had a rules and regulations around that. And as far as dealing with grounds, there's supposed to be all this paperwork. You're supposed to get anthropologists and all of that. Well, a lot of times what happens is that they kind of skip over those and go ahead and start digging, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times many of the jurisdictions are in on this because, you know, Adebayo is kind of going through that. So that's kind of like a mirror away to people. There's one incident that was in Mecklenburg, Virginia, where Microsoft is building a data center. Now, we also, yeah, like cognizant of that, where they found out that there was a family burial ground of a number of generations, and they kind of skipped over the whole process and kind of snuck in the notice and all of that. But had they just talked to somebody in the town, they would know that one of the descendants was living right there in the town, who actually was a journalist, but he had no clue.
So they probably snuck the notice somewhere in some periodical that nobody read, right?
The you know, the county, the city was kind of complicit in on it, because Microsoft is a behemoth.
Yes.
But you know, monies or what taxes or whatever was bringing in, but they weren't going to let that stop. And so that was something that was published by ProPublica recently, I guess maybe 3 or 4 years ago. There's a lot of things that have transpired that show the disregard and the disrespect. Stockholm Cemetery in Virginia, that's another interesting thing. That's been a long life thing. But what I do want to say is there are a number of organizations across the country that are addressing these things. There's a lot of quiet activists who are in the trenches trying to preserve and fighting, you know, the powers that be to bring some recognition and respect to the ancestral grounds. And there's a number of people, you know, as we go about our daily lives, this is not something that's at the top of the, you know, the top of the, it's like going to the dry cleaners to go pick up the kids, that kind of thing. But I'm going to tell you something. Being connected, understanding what your ancestors went through, understanding just the reverence around how they survived, how they put together all these different organizations, how they took care of themselves, how they shared funds, how they fed each other, how they looked out for each other, how they shared information, is just remarkable under such tyrannical authoritarian rule. It boggles the mind. Really give homage to them in terms of showing us the way of how we can currently and in contemporary times to be able to open up our eyes and be able to maneuver a little bit differently in terms of what we're doing. So being proactive instead of reactive in terms of basically what's happening right now.
When you mentioned sort of you said something that you, when you were talking about sort of they snuck in the notice and you know, and one of the family members was a journalist, and you said they could have talked with anyone, you know, in the town. When we are looking at you know, these entities, right, that go out and disregard, you know, our, you know, ancestral grounds or, you know, where our ancestors are buried. Like, what are the legal and ethical considerations, you know, that they must take, that we should be aware of? Like, what should be known?
You know, there's supposed to be some kind of survey. You're supposed to find out, you know, from the historical aspect, what was going on. As the person was saying in the previous segment, there were townships all over this country, black townships, you know, folks minding their own business, you know, and you know, a lot of those things were disrupted. And as we had got into zoning and quote unquote urban renewal on these grounds where they were formerly, you know, black enclaves, and they basically disregarded that. And there's, like I said, they're supposed to have anthropologists, you're supposed to do the history thing, you're supposed to put notices in the paper, you're supposed, and if you find something like they did in New York, then you're supposed to you know, construction and move on. Those things are not followed a lot of times. And I think the thing in New York is, like, you know, people were very vigilant about what the heck was going on, and they really came together. And that's
for our, just in case we have some listeners who are not familiar with what you mean by what happened in New York, can you take a minute to explain that?
Well, there was a site that was discovered. I mean, there's a lot of stuff around this, but it was a site that was discovered, and then there was people rallied around, and they stopped construction because they were going to do this big building. And Mayor Dinkins was, he was the mayor at the time. So that ended up being a kind of like a cool thing, because I think he kind of, unbeknownst to me, I'm not clear, basically kind of curated the situation, and they were able to be really, really involved in terms of what was going to happen with the grounds and stopping construction. And they put together coalitions, and they went to meetings, and they had vigils and all of that. And they ended up, you know, having this space where you could come to honor the ancestors.
And
it took a number of years, but it was really, really beautiful. And then my alma mater, Howard, was also involved in that. And a number of other anthropologists were involved with that. So it was a really a wonderful thing. So the outcome with that was a positive one. But we're talking about other smaller people who don't have the backing, or people are not vested to back them up, having these different types of struggles. So that was that's something that we need to really keep in mind in terms of what we can do, you know, on a community level.
Right. With 3 minutes left, because I or at this point, 2 minutes left. Now, I've read some of your research and found it incredible. You used a term in your research.
Goodness.
And so I'm just going to say that and let you pick it up from there and tell us that.
Hyperidentization.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of looked at it from, it's the same thing as, you know, the system of apartheid in South Africa, or what they practice in many parts of the world, you know, this severe separation with severe repercussions, you know. And that's basically what the history has been in terms of, you know, us being, you know, buried here, you know, dying here.
Yeah.
It's like an onslaught. It's a continuation of, you know, the whole oppression. We're going to beat you when you're alive. We're going to beat you when you're dead. You know, it's like this ongoing thing. It just never stops. And so basically that's kind of like what, and the system in and of itself promotes that type, you know, that type of treatment. And, you know, it's the perpetuation of the same thing.
That's, wow.
I mean, this has been for, 400 years, 500, it's the same thing. So when people talk about, oh, 60 years ago, we were doing so well, so, you know, in the scope of things, we are the support and the foundation. And our ancestors are extremely brilliant people. Brilliant people because, you know, as a clinician, you know, anybody who's been through what we've been through, I'm not clear on why we can even put a sentence together, to be quite honest. It's a lot. It's been a lot. And it's transgenerational.
Transgenerational. And then the idea that it, you know, it continues even through our death, that they continue to, you know, exact suffering. But not only that, continue to profit off of Black.
These firms are now getting in on the thing, and they're buying up funeral homes, and, you know, they're raising prices. And the burial, that film, The Burial, I love that film with, The Burial.
Okay.
That's a really good movie. And it talks about how these firms are buying up, you know, funeral homes.
Oh my goodness. It doesn't end, which is another reason why we really, as a collective, should be having our eyes on the on liberation, because otherwise we are never safe and secure, not even in death.
But knowing our history gives us proper context on how to proceed. And understanding this, there's nothing new up under the sun. That's the most important thing.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let you have that last word. There's nothing new under the sun. And so, Dr. Wright, I appreciate you. I love you. Thank you so much. So, WPFW family, again, thank you. We have brought to you another mighty episode. Thank you to our guests, Yetije Orunmila, president of ONWO, and Dr. Denise Wright, and your amazing research. Thank you to our executive producer, Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. I'm Denise Young, and I thank you for having me. Next up, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams. Peace and blessings. Peace and blessings.
This is a special invitation, a call for entries to We the 92%, an anthology of Black women's documenting this time. Your essays, poetry, prayers of resistance, open letters, and more, preserving our voices, our truths, and our testimony in a time when our history is being rewritten, challenged, and erased, are being accepted. Submission deadline is midnight, December 20th. Details at wethe92.com.
The Caribbean Disaster Relief and Recovery Alliance, a nonprofit 501c3 corporation, is seeking relief aid supplies for the victims of Hurricane Melissa. They are accepting non-perishable food items, toiletries, medical supplies, and monetary donations. All funds will go towards Hurricane Melissa relief. Drop-off locations and more information is available at cdrra.org. That's cdrra.org.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your Jazz and Justice station.
In 1977, the D.C. cultural landscape changed for the better when WPFW joined the airwaves and D.C. space opened their doors. On Sunday, November the 30th, a reunion party is happening at the Atlantis Club featuring Marshall Allen, Luke Stewart, Little Red and the Renegades, Bob Boylan, and more. They'll be celebrating a time when D.C. space was the place where music and politics merge to change Washington, D.C. Doors open at 5 p.m. Details at theatlantis.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Faith is the play.
Faith is the play. Thursday, November 28th, WPFW honors the National Day of Mourning, commemorates the birthday of Jimi Hendrix, and offers music centering gratitude from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. Bushmeat opens the day with a birthday tribute to Jimi Hendrix. At noon, WPFW takes you once again live to the annual United American Indians of New England rally in Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts. Finally, James Funk offers music filled with gratitude from 3 until 7 p.m. That's all here on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
You're listening to a program previously aired on WPFW. While this is not a live broadcast, we're proud to bring you this encore presentation filled with the same